night shift again. That was the kind of world we'd made. 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 World we'd
made. How does it feel?
It, feels like times have changed.
To center yourself, to be present. To be here, it is always appropriate to be here, contemplate. If you ever happen to be someplace and you contemplate, I'm not here, where are you? So in this moment, be here, wherever here happens to be. In this day and time, we have gathered together to contemplate, to dialogue this that is called...
Night shift again. 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 Night shift again.
I'll be damn late.
Now, where are my people? 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 Where are my people?
thinking about it, and I have no idea. I have no idea. I have no idea why I'm here. I don't know what I'm doing, you know, talking about this. I saw something, they saw something. There was a lot of light. That's all I remember.
Reach deep down inside yourself there and try and find something that'll keep you awake just a little while longer, because this transmission coming up may just rekindle your will to live.
This is Comm Central. Channel open for executive order AUC-3423.
Listen to this, boys.
Night shift again. 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 Night shift again.
I'll be damn late.
Now, where are my people? 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 Where are my people?
Hi, I'm Billy D. Williams for WBAI Listener Sponsored Radio. You're listening to Night Shift, where life is like science fiction.
His name's now black, now inhuman, freedom stolen, family. woman, and ain't I a woman? I can see her, me, washing dishes, clothes, and children, making love, money, dinner, and beds, always the first one off a sinking ship, but last in the line to receive respect. Seeking or achieving any kind of power reduced to labels like concubine, bitch, whore, stunt, witch, dyke. Concubine, bitch, whore, stunt, witch. For less, based upon her womanness, embrace the pronoun and power of she. No, if nothing else, the uniqueness is blessed and a necessary component in the union between universe and people, equal to man, at times above human understanding. She don't have to lay down for nothing or nobody. Her body, in and out, a wonder.
Well, you are tuned to listener-sponsored radio, WBAI 99.5 FM. The name of the show is Night Shift, and you were just listening to the music of Ursula Rucker, and the song was called What a Woman Must Do. And one of the things that a woman must do is a woman must speak a certain way, and there's a certain way we must speak about women. And to talk about that, and to debate that, and to talk about the theme of tonight's show, which is the language of women, language, gender, and the origins of how we talk to and about women. And of course, we have Dr. Kelly E. Wright. How are you?
I'm well. Good evening.
Good evening. So, all right, a couple things I want to say just to the audience here, because this is you know, I have Dr. Kelly Wright, who is among other things, a raciolinguist, a sociolinguist. What are the various things that you are? What would you, in a nutshell, what would you say that you are?
I mean, I'm a linguist. Yes. We can leave it there, but experimental sociolinguist, lexicographer, phonetician.
Yes. See, I like all these titles. All right. So you're all these things. And when I happen to send you something that was on Instagram about the language of women or how women are supposed to speak, you were like, oh, and I said, oh, we have to talk about this. You had a lot of feelings about it. And then I put together an agenda, and you've added quite a lot of things to it. But yes. Now I want to start first with some perspectives, and I want to get your definition of what we're actually talking about. So my first question to you is, what is the meaning? There's a definition here I could read, but what is the meaning of women's language to you? What does that phrase mean to you?
To me, the linguist.
The linguist. As
the linguist. So that to me is, you know, the language of individuals who identify as women, like at a given point in time or in a given community, like the women of a certain community have practices, like cultural practices that manifest in language use, right? So that's like how I think of it, in the same way that we look at, there are maybe a handful of variables like this that we're maybe always interested in, like social variables, even if somebody doesn't do sociolinguistics. And, you know, one of them is gender, and another one is where someone's from. So like your region or your area, you know, like it's not just what country you're from. It's like what part of that country you're from. You know, it's cultural. It has something to do with life ways. Right. The same with like age, like younger people use language in different ways than older people consistently, like no matter where or when you are. So age is always relevant. So like our gender, how we're expressing gender is always relevant essentially when we're using language. So women's language, you know, is the language of those who identify as women, right? Which is not a satisfying answer. It's one that can move with time, right?
Well, okay. To me, I want to, that's why I wanted to hear the answer. And I'm going to read that definition, because what I really want to do is peel back the layers of what we mean when we say that. What it's sort of like, you know, if you say to somebody, what's a man's man?
You know, a man's man.
Everybody's going to give you a different definition based on, you know, where they come from, what that means to them, the men in their lives, all of that. So I think women's language to me, you know, in my mind, when I hear that, I'm thinking a few different things. But I want to explore that with you this evening.
Yeah, absolutely. A man's man. That's an interesting one. That's one that moves with time as well.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is.
You know?
So, all right, here's a definition that I came across. It says, what is the meaning of women's language? It says, women's language, and this is in quotations, has a foundation. The attitude that women are marginal to the serious concerns of life, which are preempted by men. The marginality and the powerlessness of women is reflected in both ways women are expected to speak and in the ways women are spoken of. Now, do you agree with this assessment? You're muted. Did you mute yourself on purpose?
Yeah, no, I didn't. I'm sorry. In some ways, yeah. Powerlessness is a strong term. Marginality, I certainly agree with, or at least like decentralization of the ways of women, you know, women in general, and yeah, this expectation that there is like a certain way to speak and that women are spoken of. I don't know that anything in here is maybe different from, like, you could be like, you know, like anything that seems marginal is like regular life, you know, like a holistic medicine has like, right? Like the attitude that like, it's like, you're not, it's not serious and it's marginal to the ways of life. I mean, we could also like, yeah, this idea that what we're talked about is reflected in the ways we're expected to speak and the ways in which like things are spoken of. You could say that about essentially anything.
Yeah, but Mara, now here's my take on that. My take on that is that, you know, that marginality, even if you were saying, you know, let's say holistic medicine, it's because of the dominant culture, of the dominant thinking, the dominant, you know, whatever Western medicine is, then if it doesn't include that, it may dismiss Eastern medicine just because that's sure. So to me, that marginal has to do with, you know, where is this formed? Like, where are these attitudes,
isn't that an interesting question?
Yeah, go ahead. What were you gonna say?
Oh, I'm just saying, like, it's something to get lost in.
It is. Well, because here's the thing, a phrase like "you talk like a girl." Now, what that's sort of like, you know, what's a man's man? That means different things to different people. But if someone said that to you, or you heard that being said to someone, as a linguist, what would be your take on that? What is that? What do you think people mean when they say something like that?
Okay, so there's maybe this kind of interesting, I don't want to call it a divide. There's a difference between what we are able to measure in speech or language production, like what we can objectively point to in the sound signal. So for, you know, I record it, I bring it into some very advanced software, right? And use that to analyze it. So there are things that are like objectively present in speech, right? Those speech features that we as scientists can systematically describe, don't always, or in some cases ever, match up with the ways that people consistently describe speech. Those two things are really difficult to match up. So when people say like "talk like a girl," that could mean different things for different people. And again, like through time. So if I ask you, it's going to be different than how I feel. All of that said, it's usually pretty consistent. There are things that end up being pretty consistent, right? Like, so if I asked 100 people, if I asked 500 people, they're not going to give us the things that we can objectively measure. They're going to tell us things like women speak faster, you know, and their voices are higher pitched, right? Or that there are certain ways or words that they say. Right. You know, in the same way that if I said like, these people are Southern, like what is Southern speech like? You know, they would say maybe it's slower. these people sound like X, right?
I guess I feel like you're kind of giving it you know, sort of the Spock answer. Well, Captain, I think when, but I do think in many ways, there's a gendered thing to that. I don't think a woman would say to another woman, "You speak like a girl." I think that's something a man would say potentially to another man, to as an insult, to say that he maybe sounds emotional or erratic or, you know, it's some characteristic that is generally attributed to women. That's my take on it, but do you feel that's wrong or
Oh no, it's not wrong. Okay, this is incredibly multifaceted. So that phrase, like a girl, if we, you know,
you run
put
like
it into some different very sophisticated software, we could see, you know, its neighbors over time, like what that word has occurred with. And so like or like and you know, who's used it. So if you see it coming out of like the mouths of men when they're talking to other men, like feminization of all sorts of things, you know, happens in these spaces, in these like homosocial spaces where like men are together with each other. They're always
homosocial. I've never heard that phrase. Homosocial.
Homosocial.
Okay. Homosocial. Okay.
And so I don't think it's wrong, especially, and it's very interesting because, you know, you see something like a brand like Nike using like a girl, picking that up and using it as part of their branding of being like, it's a good thing to like run like a girl, or like, this is like what it means to run like a girl, hit like a girl, swim like a girl, you know, like all that stuff of it being so like female empowerment or something,
right,
of
right.
like taking
redefining
back.
It. We're taking the phrase
of being
back.
Like, if somebody tells you run like a girl, you should be proud. Right. Instead of like some kid who just like flails his legs to the side or can't hit a baseball for whatever. Right.
Well, you know, that's interesting, and I want to get to that. I don't know what that's called or if there is something in that linguistics where you take something, you know, maybe we touched upon it before, something that is considered an insult. I mean, sometimes that happens natural where something, you know, you can say that's bad, and it used to mean that's bad, and then it becomes that actually bad means good. So when you take something that's an insult and then reframe it, is that just something that normally just occurs naturally in language or is advertising something that's always trying to do that, like, you know, think different?
Well, okay, so it's both, right? Well, we see this is that a normal thing where like a phrase gets like reanalyzed and can go from like negative to positive?
Yeah, that's just a sidebar here because I'm interested.
Yeah, sure. That's not unusual. Neither is like taking a piece of language that is currently negative and deliberately trying to turn it positive. That kind of thing does happen. Like reclamation, I think, is the ways that some people talk about that. Reclamation also gets used in other ways in the literature, but yeah.
Okay.
So it is interesting. Now, there's also, you know, when you're talking about advertising, there are lots of reasons to like use phrasing that we can maybe talk about, like dog whistles or like sentiment analysis, like things like this that like corporations do to figure out how to push our button.
Well, that's also too, advertising is a place also where they give a lot of thought to how to quote unquote talk to women, you know, and then you can see.
Well, we are the, you know, the most important consumers. We keep the economy running.
There it is. All right. So, you know, you've been breaking down. I'm going to go to the definition here, and I want to know if you agree with this, because we've been talking about the characteristics of the language of women. And this definition here says that in phonology, features of language of women are mainly present in pronunciation, as you were saying, tone, as you were saying, pitch. Vocabulary of women is more abundant, polite, and euphemistic than men. The features of language that women contain intensifiers and exaggerated adjectives, interjections, nicknames, or diminutive and color words. Well, that's a very interesting description of the characteristics. And what's your take on that, please, as a woman and as a linguist?
Okay, so this is such a huge list of things. I think it is interesting to think about this, about how this, like, I guess, like, constellation of variables or like ways in which language can vary. I think that's maybe what's most interesting to me about this sort of thing, is that in any one sentence, like, any woman could be doing all of these things at once.
How dispassionate a women's language contains intensifiers. That's not saying, you know, they're overly dramatic. They contain intensifiers.
Well, they do. I mean, and we all do it, but it's like, okay, so what nicknames, diminutives, and color words is an interesting one. That's one also that, you know, maybe like over time, because when okay, so linguistics as a formalized discipline, not very old, right? Like 80 years, like 40s, right? Like 1940s. So this, when we really get organized and start thinking about gender, there are maybe two major avenues that that happened through. One of them is through like starting to define this characteristic, these characteristics of features that are common to like the ways women in general, and we are really thinking about like the world's women, and maybe over time and through time, right? With, right? Are using language. But then there's also like work on sexuality and this idea that like, you know, like male to male relationships, the people who get it, who are in male and male relationships have like these ways of languaging that are different from like other adult males, right? And how like, yeah, like where those, what there's, those are like two distinct paths that don't meet up and maybe haven't quite met up still in literature. So I think that that's maybe important because like fundamental work on gender has a lot to do with, these like two deviations from the norm. And the literature is very much organized that way. So when you're saying like, here's what women do, it is defining it in opposition to what we've already said men do, or like all language users do. And it's like, actually, no, here's what women do. Here's what gay people do. Here's what Southerners do. Here's what Black people do. Here's what all Eastern languages do. Right? Like that kind of, we just started chunking off these distinctions.
All right. A couple things stand out to me here, though, about this whole, you know, like you said, it is a constellation of you know, aspects of quote unquote how women speak.
There's a lot in here that I like and can give you some cool examples of.
Oh, please, please. I'd like, because there are a couple of things that occurred to me, but please give me the examples first. Go ahead.
Okay, so, well, and Robin Lakoff, which maybe we'll get in a little deeper to Language and Women's Place, which is a text from our field in like this 1970s. She talks about like words.
Now, just for those who are listening, that's the name of the book, Language and.
That's the name of the book.
The name of the
language
book is Language and Women's
the
Place.
Woman's Place.
And the Woman's Place, and the author is Robin Lakoff, Lakoff, just in case.
And there's some pretty good videos of Lakoff giving, you know, some talks, talking about the book, talking about her, you know, so there's a lot out there to maybe consume about her perspective. And she taught at Michigan. I graduated from Michigan, so we're like intellectually related.
Intellectually related. So, all right. So now, but, what are your thoughts on her work, and how do you feel it's impacted this whole, you know, I guess the conversation?
I guess that's kind of where I was headed, is like, you know, someone needed to start chunking, you know, to start carving this statue, whatever it was, right? Like somebody had to take a chisel to the marble first. So Lakoff is like doing some of this work to like excavate out like what makes women's languaging not the same as the way, like when, right, when we're defining the field of like all language users, like we're not there yet because we haven't described everyone thoroughly. So it is certainly not like, and was never meant to be like the be all and end all treatise on gender. But it is just meant to be like, here's what we feel like we can say about this constellation of features that varies. And so, yeah, one of the things that I wrote down several that we could talk about, but there's a couple maybe that are really interesting. And one of them is like stress, like this idea that we, that women emphasize like certain like words or terms in their sentences, like when they're saying them, they say a certain word like more emphatically, like no, like instead of directly clarifying or like asking, or like connecting and comparing ideas. So an example might be like, no, we said the way that women, you know, emphasize their language use, like emphasize their language use instead of me being like a direct correction. Or, you know, we spoke about this before, like, da, 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 like none of the ways that men might do the same thing in discourse. So like women are, instead of directly reemphasizing a point, like actually reemphasizing a point in the way that they say language or the way that they are using it, the same sentence. Does that make sense? I feel like I'm all over the place.
Well,
the other one is color terms. We can talk about color terms.
Well, you're speaking in women's language, so I'm trying. No, I'm kidding. But you know, it's interesting because, again, I'm looking at this through a certain lens here, you know, or trying to, because, you know, this whole topic, what's fascinating is to me about it overall is that there's so much about it we take for granted. So when I read something like a woman's, you know, like you're talking about how, you know, you said they emphasize certain things in this description, there was abundant, polite, and euphemistic. They're more abundant, polite, and euphemistic. And you think, now, why would someone want to be more polite and more euphemistic and more abundant unless that was what they felt they had to do to be heard? So some of, quote-unquote, women's language has to do, in my take on it, is in the position that they occupy, you know, socially, and how men think of them. So I'm wondering if you think that what your thoughts are on that facet or that influence on, quote unquote, women's language.
Yeah. So this is where we start to maybe approach what I do and am most interested in, because, and truly most interested in, is this idea of, you know, who you imagine to be out there listening to you in the world. Like, I may go into a room full of strangers, some of them men and some of them not, and still use language in this way, right? Like, not be motivated by direct experience with individuals, right? I just have like an idea of who is listening. Like, this is maybe something that people think of as like the male gaze, right? Of this big concept. That softer, gentler language that women and other people like use to get their language, their like needs met. It's like not something that we're ever directly taught or we're not supposed to be, you know, like something like finishing school exists. Finishing school, you know, is this idea that like women need to be taught this etiquette to like move through society in such a way that no one will ever think bad about them or their families or think that they're slutty, so that they can get like good husbands and never, you know, like this kind of thing of being able to like move in society. We don't get that kind of explicit teach.
Men never go to finishing school.
Huh. Men never go to finishing school. Well, I get, well, what is Eton?
You know, they don't call it finishing school, so, but you know, no, you make
what
a really good
point.
What
was that place that they sent King Charles? What was it? That's, you know, whatever.
No, but continue. I just think when you say finishing school, yeah, that's just not
something. Well, that's the thing, is like this, the things that you would be taught in finishing school, like officially, are some of these things that are being like, and that's like, I think Lakoff's main, I guess, like argument, or what people like really criticize about that earlier work, is saying that women are taught how to defer to men and do these things and keep themselves safe and or like gain like a different type of advantage, you know, in like in the workplace or like these other ways of being. And I think it's like equal parts, you know, like that idea, like it's equal parts, like different things are different. And, you know, that's what socialization is. Like, I think the things that people press on in this book are not particularly revolutionary of the idea that we learn how to do this. So there's some really interesting science that demonstrates that children, like one way, like I was saying, there's some things that we can like objectively measure about how people use voices, right? And one of them is saying like a man, like a man's voice or like a typical man's voice versus a typical woman's voice. Like, why are we able to say something like that? Or like, what do we mean when we say something like that? Is there are like physiological differences that put like most male-bodied people into like this range of hertz, essentially, like a frequency. And like these people, you know, like female-bodied people are in a different, because we're like physiologically smaller, you know, for like the species or whatever. Vocal tract length is how we measure that. It is, you know, like a bigger tube makes a deeper sound, right? So children move to those ends of that, the scale, right? Like baby girls, young, you know, like infants, children, adolescents move towards the like female end of the scale and the male end of the scale before their vocal tracts make them do that. So men produce deeper voices and women produce higher pitched voices before they have to, because there's like an actual difference in their physiology. And it's like years and years before, you know? So when people are like, so this you're indoctrinating our children with gender, I'm like, that happens anyway. Like, I don't know. Don't let them outside. Like, take away their phones.
So this is what you meant when you wrote prepubescent children who make use of their metalinguistic awareness of the gender distribution of acoustic variables.
Correct.
Now, you also talked about, made a couple notes here about lexically, the difference. You said gender is considered grammatically, but not socially. And you mentioned two things: the bachelor versus the spinster. Now, tell me what you were implying there.
Well, so those are words from like Lakoff's list, there are a number of them there's ways that the language is gendered, right? And then that's one thing. And then there's ways that people with gender use the language, right? And both of these things are interesting. So the lexical aspects of gender, are things which are common, you know, are marked in the world's languages in different ways. So when people think about learning like Spanish, you know, it's like these words have gender, like these words are female and these words are male and they have different endings and blah, blah. That is like grammatical gender, right? So that is when we're looking at these like lexical items that are maybe confined by gender, that's something different. That's like, but yeah, so she, and that's essentially what she's talking about, is saying like, this isn't grammatical gender in the way we normally think about it, but it is like controlled. It is like controlled by this like social understanding of what we're discussing. So a bachelor, like we don't think about like a female bachelor, right? Even though I guess bachelorhood certainly exists for women, but this idea of like an unmarried woman of a certain age being a spinster, or you having like a spinster sister, the ways in which those words function in society and like are, you know, like they're, one of them is considerably more negative than the other.
Well, you know, it's interesting. There are a lot of different terms for an unmarried woman. Like I think we might have done, there are a lot of like, some of them are like interesting, fun terms, but you're right. There is no male equivalent. It's sort of like concubine.
Well, and that's what she's trying to say, is like, this is a pair, like that they select like through the same life stage, or, you know, of men versus women. And she's talking about like the difference of how like one of them is very much weighted differently and gets used in regular conversation. Like, I don't think most people use the term spinster anymore. Like, unless it is like, you know, like what, you know, like someone's maidenaunt. Like, I don't think like we talk about that in the same way that we used to, but without it being a bit of a joke. No. But Bachelor, like Bachelor Pad, I don't know, like that people really say that, but it's certainly still a concept that's not an issue, right?
Right. It's still socially acceptable.
Or maybe even fries, like it's like a bachelor. Like a valued state of life for men as opposed to spinsterhood for women, which is like the worst thing you could be. It's like drawing the old maid in Go Fish.
Right. Well, you know, and that's interesting too, because again, that suggests, you know, what the dominant society or dominant culture is now. Now there's another book or another topic that I wanted to say. You touched upon it a little bit earlier, you know, because all of this, how women talk and how they're supposed to talk or how they can talk and actually be heard, comes into language use in the workplace. So I had read a BBC article that was surprising to me, but before I read anything from that, I wanted to know your thoughts on it, because you wrote sociolinguistic labor. So I wanted to know.
Well, that was like in response to your article, so let's hear about it.
All right, so the name of this article, and I'm not going to read the whole article, but this is just enough for you to get to this. It says, there's an article from the BBC. It's from a little over a year ago, and it's called The Coded Language That Holds Women Back at Work. And it says here, and this is the headline under the main headline, workplace language encodes gendered expectations that feed into who we hire, how we assess people, and who we promote, holding some people back. And the article, I hit the wrong button there, hold on a second. So the article goes on to talk about just a couple things here, what they call the agentic communal spectrum. It says gender researchers often discuss the differences between agentic and communal language and behaviors. Now, just for those who don't know what the heck that is, what the heck is that, Kelly?
Okay, so they're saying that it's a different.
Yes, what's agentic?
I know. I would say agentic. They say it's the difference between like confident usage, like so. Agentic is right. Being confident and right. Decisive.
Right, having agency. Having agency.
Having agency.
Yes.
Right. Versus whereas communal like language. Communal is being like warm and helpful, like using your energy to just like aid others instead of you know, knowing what you're. Yeah, serving a different purpose.
All right, so for those who are not scientists listening, so it says gender researchers often discuss the differences between agentic and communal language and behavior. To be agentic, it says to be confident and decisive. To be communal is to be warm and helpful. It says in many countries, including seemingly progressive ones, men are still perceived as more agentic, while women continue to be viewed as more communal. And to me, I also think this plays into the idea that, you know, a man can be like, you know, hard, and he's a hard, you know, he's a tough, you know, boss. But if a woman is like that, she's going to be labeled a different B word, not the boss. So I wanted to know if you had, you know, I'll go on in the article. It says that this feeds into persistent ideas about women, particularly women of color, being less suited for leadership. It's as much of the language and leadership and certain types of jobs inclines towards agency, sending intended or not a gender coded message about who the ideal candidate is. So what that suggests to me is that the very way in which women are encouraged to talk is what would keep them out, that creates like its own glass ceiling.
Well, yes. I mean, in some ways, yes. It's also fascinating too that like these ideologies about language use, again, like parts of it are demonstrable, but like we can measure it, right? But we also know, like from these types of examples, that it doesn't actually matter how women are using language in these spaces. So this idea of like being more confident or being like less warm, being more decisive, speaking deeper, speaking slower, like adjusting all of these parts of the constellation that seem distinctly female, don't end up with women being perceived like men are perceived as like leaders or, you know, these like clear-eyed visionaries or whatever, right? Or even just like not B words, right? Like, or not like cold or, insert all these other adjectives like shrill. You know, you never hear men described as shrill. That sort of thing, that's what happens, is when women adopt these practices that are more traditionally male in the workplace, they're not perceived the way men are perceived. They're perceived as different types of women and still have, you know, these barriers. So they're saying, like, particularly Black women. Well, of course, because Black women also have to deal with those same types of ideologies about race. And we also know that Black people, no matter how they use language in the workplace, like, it can be the most standard language that it can be more. This is another thing that Lakoff says, is like hyper grammaticality. Like, it can be super formal. It can sound like a book when it falls out of your mouth, more formal than the rest of your colleagues. And still, you get notes about how you use language in the workplace and or lose opportunities because of it.
Well, you know, in the article here, it says, and they're talking about not just leadership, but just getting hired. And it says even if there's a gender diverse pool of applicants, recruiters may still use gender coded words and views in hiring decisions. It says for someone of any gender to be hired, they generally need to demonstrate competence, you know, efficiency. Yet when the candidate is a woman, hiring decisions are more likely to factor in their sociability, their friendliness and morality, their trustworthiness as compared to male candidates.
So, well, I'll tell you.
Yeah, so they're kind of judged to a completely different standard. Go ahead, what were you going to say?
Oh, no, please.
You said, I'll tell you. What were you going to say?
Oh, well, there's something interesting about this, like, intersection with, like, perceived gender and trustworthiness that falls out of my work as well. So I did a study about access to housing and the ways people who speak different linguistic varieties when they're on the phone, like making an initial contact with, like, a landlord or somebody who's renting a property, like how their experiences differ, right? Like how their access to housing, like their outcomes differ. So I used like recordings from that to, like, ask people about how they characterize these voices. So we have, like, an idea of what, like, a general listener, like anybody who could pick up the phone, might hear. And when a woman is using Black language, like a Black variety, as opposed to, like, a Southern variety or a standard variety, right? They're perceived as slightly more masculine sounding, right? Like, it's not like I hear a man talking. It's like on a scale of 0 to 100, tell me how masculine this voice is. And it's slightly more masculine sounding, the Black voice. But that little skosh of masculinity, right? Of additional perceived masculinity in a clearly feminine voice. Like, I know this is a woman. It also sounds a little more masculine than these other two women, right? That little bit of perceived masculinity really drops the trustworthiness rating of those voices. So, and it is masculinity. It is this perceived masculinity that has, like, the most distinct effect on this trustworthiness rating.
Interesting.
So, yeah. And so we actually end up seeing, like, lots of negative traits clustering, but it seems to be this, like, rootedness in this perceived masculinity, which makes this Black woman slightly less trustworthy to general listeners. And it's, I cannot explain that link, but I can tell you that this perception of trustworthiness has a lot to do with someone's gender, or perceived gender as well, or where they should fit on a perceived gender spectrum. So, for example, if someone is transitioning genders, if they appear masculine but sound slightly more feminine, that directly affects their perception of perception of trustworthiness.
Well, it is kind of fascinating, and I'll just read a little more to the, they said that the hurdles don't stop once a woman is hired. Now, they're talking about gender bias in performance reviews. It says research on performance evaluation suggests that regardless of the gender of the evaluator, different words are used to describe how men and women perform. It said a study of military performance evaluation showed that more negative characteristics were recorded for women overall, possibly because stereotypes of women that didn't match the conventional mode of military leadership. Compassionate was a common descriptor of women, whereas competent was frequently used for men in terms of negative feedback. Irresponsible was more often applied to men, whereas judgmental and gender-coded terms like frivolous and temperamental were usually likely to be mentioned for women. So, and it says similar disparities exist in different industries. So now, does this, any of this surprise you, or is this really supported by the work you're already doing?
No, it's not surprising. I know you're just smiling. So there's some things in here that are maybe interesting. Like they're making a comparison about, just like terms that are being applied to women in a certain context. And that actually can be really informative. So they're looking at like the military, where there's lots of really formalized ways that they use language, and these types of reports, they're going to be more comparable than reports in like a different field, because there's like probably, I mean, they're like, is a form, you know, so there's actually blanks being filled, which makes these things like rise to the surface. I know we talked previously about like fixed phrasing. Like, you know, like this, the suspect made a furtive movement. Like, ladies and gentlemen, well, like fixed phrasing boxes. Anyway, I'm getting like way too into process. I'm a huge nerd. Can you tell?
No. Well,
but I do, you know, this confident versus like in some of my work, we see things like this, like, athletic, like the term athletic itself is used more often with Black athletes than white athletes. It's not like it isn't used with white athletes. It's just like significantly more, demonstrably more with Black people. And you would imagine all world-class athletes would be described as athletic. It's like something that's expected to be neutral. So these terms here, like compassionate, is maybe not expected to be neutral. But it's still interesting.
It is. Well, you cited, in your notes here, a couple other books that delve into this. Even more specifically, one is called Shifting the Double Lives of Black Women in America, and by, I think, the same author, Shorter Gooden.
This work's amazing.
Yeah, and then the first one, and the second one, African American Women's Voices Project. So tell me a little bit about these, because clearly you're familiar with her work, and this is something that I think clearly dovetails into the whole idea of the language of women use in the workplace, or how women are treated as, and language is used against them.
Yeah. So people really need to look like no further than this African American Women's Voices Project, to like understand this phenomenon like more deeply, because essentially it follows from 2000 to 2002, follows like the experiences of over 300 US women, in the workplace, Black women in the workplace. And there are these like common experiences which float to the surface, that are, you know, irrespective of like age and profession and where they live and this sort of thing that would maybe think. Yeah. And I guess there are two things that fall out of it that are really interesting. One of them is what she calls like this watering down phenomenon, she asks women, like, tell me about your workday, or like what, you know, how you gear up for your workday. And a lot of women say like, I do all this work to, you know, change my hair, change my appearance. Like, we think about code switching maybe as something that like only happens with the language. And then this is the way like people are describing it, maybe like a decade before we had that terminology, is saying like, when I go into the workplace, I water myself down. And here's the way I do it, because I make sure like I am not the loudest person in the room or the first person to speak, you know, or, you know, I'm not using like certain words because people don't understand them, or I'm making sure that like the ends of my words are clear. You know, I want to articulate. I want to do this. I want to do that. But also doing this thing to like blend in makes Black women, there's like this stage of success at work. This is the thing of you saying that like women doing all these things maybe gets you a job, but it doesn't help you like keep a job. Like the work doesn't end when you get hired.
Correct.
Because these women talk about like this invisibility stage that a lot of people actually like get stuck in and has these like psychological consequences over time, over a life of work, right? Is that like you, once you fit in, then you fade into the background. You remove like all of these aspects of self, which identify you with your race and your culture of any kind. And if you are successful at doing that, you have to remain invisible. You have to remain someone in your workplace who doesn't stand out. If you end up like becoming too successful or doing something that actually brings attention back on you, you're Black again.
I do. Well, I do want to take a break here. You are tuned to Listener Sponsored Radio, WBAI 99.5 FM. And we are talking about the language of women, or women's language, or how we talk of women. And we're talking with our resident raciolinguist, Dr. Kelly E. Wright, and in a little while we'll be taking phone calls, but I do want to make an announcement that there is something special happening tomorrow. There is a screening of a movie called The River You Step In. It's a film release party. It is at the Atamian Hovsbian Curatorial Practice. It's a new art gallery at 227 East 24th Street. That's 227 East 24th Street, Manhattan. And 10% of all proceeds go for the Joyful Heart Foundation. It's an organization that supports women's safety and the end to domestic abuse and sexual violence. And it's founded by none other than Law & Order SVU actress Mariska Hargitay. And 10% of proceeds also go to the Armenia Fund, supporting Armenian refugees fleeing their ancestral homes in Artsakh. Now, The River You Step In is a gritty, female, character-driven, award-winning Canadian drama. It's a feature film debut of writer-director John Mickelson, who is also the artistic director of the Mercury Theatre in Toronto. It stars Astrid von Nieuwenhuizen of Broadway and Apple TV Plus. Show, I don't know if any of you watch Come From Away, and she also won 3 Best Actress Awards for her performance in The River You Step In, and another award recently at the Chicago Indie Film Festivals. Now, tomorrow, the actual reception is at 6. The screening is at 7. And there's a Q&A with the filmmakers, John Mickelson and Astrid von Nieuwenhuizen, and moderated by film series curator Christopher Atamian. There will be refreshments provided. And if you say that you are a WBAI listener, of course, there's a suggested donation. But say that you're a BAI listener, that you listen to Night Shift, and they will let you in. So, again, it is tomorrow, Tuesday, October 10th, at the Atamian Hovsbian Curatorial Practice. That's 227 East 24th Street, 6, 7, and 9. Go see The River You Step In.
And is Mariska Hargitay going to be there?
I'm not going to tell you. You got to go and you'll find out.
Grateful, ungracious eyes ogle at eighth wonderfuls, wonder fill small minds that make no time for sincerity. For sincerity. God fruit, we. Sugary, plentiful. Not rib bone alone, soul, home. No, evil does not derive from my name. No, evil does not derive from my name. Fertilizer feeds the earth, but from the earth come the flowers. But from the earth come the flowers, the flowers, the flowers. Ungrateful, ungracious eyes ogle at eighth wonderfuls, wonder-filled small minds that make no time. Ungrateful, ungracious eyes ogle at eighth wonderfuls, wonder-filled small minds that make no time for sincerity. Empty the pretend praise, raised brows and penises await response from fly Venuses, who grace each sidewalk square with a mastery of movement and mind, misadmired by the masses. All they can or want to see are scantily clad asses that swing and beg to be slapped during self-satisfying sex. Say my name. Ain't no sisters or mamas here to protect, just bitches and tricks to catch in traps of covert compliments and Jesus judgment. Strong-willed women and divas seen as asking for it, home-wrecking whores with no morals. Sounds like Salem and slavery to me. Ungracious, ungrateful eyes ogle at eighth wonderfuls, wonder-filled small minds that make no time for sincerity. Ungrateful, ungracious eyes ogle at eighth wonderfuls, wonder-filled small minds that make no time, make no time, make no time for sincerity, for sincerity, for sincerity. A rebel, an inherent queen. No thing, situation, or person can steal my birthright. I came forth in the night, a force to be unreckoned with. You sure you want to get with this? Some may attempt to falter my steps, knock me down, but I'm resilient. I just bounce, I just bounce, 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 bounce. Able to leap from small minds in a single bound. Land feet first on the ground. I abound with she-lectricity. I'ma sing my woman song, make you listen to me. I'ma sing my woman song, make you listen to me. Make you listen, make you listen. Why you covet my rhythm? Why you treat me like the unforgiven? Call me mystery, like the shroud of Turin. I'm more than, I'm more than. Your doormat, your sugar tit, your own personal supply of bliss, your in-house ass to kick. Eyes ogle at eighth wonderfuls, wonder-filled small minds that make no time. Ungrateful, ungracious eyes ogle at eighth wonderfuls, wonder-filled small minds that make no time. Ungrateful, ungracious eyes ogle at eighth wonderfuls, wonder-filled small minds that make no time. Make no time, make no time, make no time, make no time for sincerity. For sincerity.
to Listener Sponsored Radio. WBAI. There's another text, Dr. Kelly Wright, that is very well known that also deals with women's language, and it's a book called Mother Tongue by Jenny Natal, and it's the origins of how we talk about women, and it specifically breaks down a lot of different words, and you made some notes. Now, what are your thoughts on this book, this work, and were you, I'm assuming you're familiar with it, and what how did it impact in any way what you do?
Well, maybe we should tell them a little bit about it.
Yes, I'm sorry. Okay. Do you want to tell them about it? I'd like you to do it because, you know, you're the linguist. All right.
Jenny Natal's book is interesting. She talks about the word, like how words that describe like women's bodies and their work and their lives like move through the lexicon and therefore the world, like things that have to do with like reproduction and aging and like nurturing. And so it's interesting because for my work, I write for a dictionary. As we've talked about a few times, it's called Among the New Words. And to do that, I'm often called to like look into the history of terms, which tells us like a lot about how words move through the world. And what's maybe interesting about this is this work is we've been talking a lot about like gender and maybe like touching up against like gender inequality or, you know, like oppression, prejudice. This work is maybe interesting, like interestingly demonstrates like the ways in which like language is gendered, but it doesn't have anything to do with, like actual oppression. It just has to do with like how gender manifests in the world. Same thing when like I look at like racialization, I'm not always looking, that doesn't mean that I'm looking at like racism that's like active in the world. It means that I'm like trying to understand how race is described or like conceptualized. So that's part of what this book, you know, this Mother Tongue book is giving us, is this idea of like how womanhood or like femininity has been like constructed in the language over time.
That's actually the best description, how it's been constructed over time. I think that's an apt description, and it takes a lot of words, like I said, that, you know, I never really wondered where the word vagina came from, but it tells you in the book that it came from a Latin word for scabbard, and that Rialdo Colombo, who was an Italian anatomist, described it in his textbook in 1559 as a place that the penis enters as if into a sheath. By the 17th century, vagina had caught on with French physicians, and it found its way into English by 1612 by way of a translated French text. Now, I felt
all of the lady parts found their way into English through a translated French text.
Well, what's interesting about that, because that's something you described too, how words kind of work their way into, you know, you know, the lexicon, into language, into for even
every single one of them has a story like this. All of them is hiding some sort of history in this way.
All right. Well, you mentioned euphemisms and diphemisms. Now, most people know what a euphemism is, but
what's a dysphemism?
A dysphemism.
So okay. Yeah. So
I said Dyson because I'm thinking Eric Meisel Dyson. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Oh, no, you're fine. Or okay. Star Trek, so, and we talked sphere. A little bit about like women. We already mentioned euphemisms and saying that like women use them more. So a euphemism is like a way to refer to something without using it directly, without mentioning it directly. And for a lot of things, they're these like harsh or like taboo concepts. So if we want to refer to them in like polite society, again, like we're going to soften what we're discussing, you know, and sometimes it, and so an example of this is like, if someone died, we might say like, they passed on, or they passed away, you know, like that's a euphemism, right? A dysphemism though does the same thing. Like it refers to something without, you know, like talking about it directly. But it does so in like a, not, it's not just softening, it's like maybe poking fun or, you know, so it's doing the same thing of like an indirect reference, but it is saying it in like a gross way. And so like what, so, okay, so this list.
Like saying he's kicked the bucket. Terms, he's kicked the bucket would be a dysphemism.
He's kicked the bucket is exactly.
That's more diffamistic.
6 feet under. Like that six kind of thing under. Is like okay. More of a dysphemism than a euphemism. Gotcha. Right. It's got that like tinge. So, you know, this list, I saw that we had the history of vagina was coming up today. It's yes. One of my very favorite things to discuss.
Of course.
So, this list that I share with you, I used on a final exam, and it is euphemisms and dysphemisms for vagina that have existed throughout our language. And you know, my students were asked to like describe the various linguistic processes that are taking place to form these words and, you know, et cetera. But you have something like vajazzle, which is very exciting. You know, like a vajazzle sounds like something I'd like to see versus.
This is quite a list, by the way. Like,
it's
quite a list. But
what's interesting, you know, or like, okay, so spasm chasm, that one is like,
moose,
you know,
knuckle.
Getting
moose knuckle.
That's an oldie. That's a stalwart. Or something like snatch, which like,
well,
you
yeah,
know,
that,
like,
yeah,
like,
yeah.
Like, but that's what I'm saying is like, it's drifting into that like dysphemistic territory. What is interesting about these terms is that
squish that, mitten. Wow.
That there are some things that are common here. One of them is this like sheath.
Yes.
Metaphor.
Yes.
So that sheath metaphor that was present when it came into English is still persistent. It is persistent to this day. We are still making productive use of that part of that original addition of that word, this word into the language. Like we are still using it in exactly the same way. There's also, you know, like some other things that have popped up over time, like fishiness.
Some of these are just like, wow, clam chops. I never heard of some of these. Like,
my favorite is the eye that weeps most when best pleased.
Wow. That like what century was that?
I don't know.
Wow.
The best century. I'm sorry. No, I'm just kidding.
Cyprian
yeah, some of
strength.
These, you can get lost in this list.
Wow. This is, I don't even want to ask about the jigaboo canoe. I don't even want to ask about
that.
Yeah, I don't even want to know.
A lot of these are pretty horrifying.
There are, some of these are, I can't even say them.
And this is the thing
words.
Is like, all of these words exist because you cannot say vagina. You can't say it. It's all of these terms exist because it's not something that gets talked about out in the world. So everyone has come up with some other way to talk about it.
But you know what's interesting about that? It's not one of the seven words.
Oh, it is not one of these.
It's not one of the seven words.
Seven words.
That's right. You can say any of these, this gigantic list of euphemisms and diphemisms. for the word vagina, which is, how many are on here, by the way?
I think, I don't know, 100 or 80 or something like that, that they could pick from. But there's a lot more.
Okay, Fangita? Wow. Like, I don't even understand. But yeah, okay, some of these are just, wow. All right, yeah, and now.
Oh, I think it's Fangita.
Oh, Fangita. Well, that makes it, you know, understandable then.
You're like, sure.
Yeah, okay. Some of these, wow. Okay, wow. Squish mitten. All right, so you also have something here I've never heard of, and I love this title here. English is a Foreign Anguish. Talk to me.
Do yourself the favor. Do yourself the favor of watching the video for that. Okay. At some point, it's excellent. It's a poem by N.R.B.C. Phillip, which essentially the idea we're talking about, like, mother tongue in this book that we're talking about by Jenny Nuttall. That's just like a creative turn of phrase, right? Like, she's not actually discussing mother tongues, but the mother tongue is certainly a concept, right? Like, globally and in the literature. And we think about it as like our first language, like the language we acquire. And honestly, like, the foundations of my field have a lot of work of trying to understand what the mother tongue like actually is, like in a measurable sense of what's universal to like all humans, like what it is that we are being passed down through our biology that like allows us to be languagers, in the same way that like we have aspects of our biology that are passed down that allows us to like walk on two legs, right? Like, it's so, this idea of like a mother tongue being not only something that is simultaneously shared between all humans, but at the same time is incredibly individualized and also marks us, like moves us through the world. So what is being discussed here in this poem is really this distance between colonial English and whatever this original language was that connected like Black people to their culture and their continent, and how like every single day when words are being used, like we're somehow either pulling ourselves closer to or farther away from that like original mother tongue. And mother tongue isn't only a Black concept, but this is a Black woman, you know, writing about her own experiences.
Well, I'm looking at the article you put here, and there is actually a video. It's a 7-minute poem. I wish I had known. I probably would have done it.
It's striking.
Should we just play it and not take calls? Or what are your thoughts?
Oh, no, we should take calls, but people should definitely look it up because it's very good.
All right. So, and just for those who may not have caught it, it is, can you spell his name? English is a Foreign Anguish. I guess if you just look up English is a Foreign Anguish, you'll find it, because I can't.
Yeah, and it's it. N.R.B.C. It's her name is N.R.B.C. Phillip. It's N.O.U.R.B.E.S.E.
Phillip. Okay. And before we take some calls, you also had something, reference here, 3 ways to speak English. Now, what are the 3 ways to speak English? This is from a TED Talk by Jamila Lisiscott, right?
Yeah, and so it's a similar concept, but a different person from a different maybe like time period and background interpreting the same thing. So the way that we're talking about, like, sociolinguistic labor, you know, like what Black women experience in the workplace, what women experience in the workplace. That's the thing, is like, of course we all change our language. Nobody talks at work the same way they talk at home or to their best friend or to their mom. That's expected, you know, that's part of just like what makes different contexts different. But not everyone describes like that type of motion between contexts as like laborious. of like feeling like work or something they have to put on or do every day. Like maybe it's something they have done, right? But that doesn't make it like part of their daily practice. So what Jamila Alyssa Scott is talking about here is like moving through her three tongues from being, you know, somebody who has, you know, an ethnic heritage, like lives in a place and also like is like exists in a black body and is trying to like learn, is trying to like exist in a higher education, like an area of higher education. So just this, I think that, yeah, that video is, or the TED talk, which is very short. The video is very short. You know, can describe again, like we're talking about the constellation of features on one hand. This maybe really shows us what it is like to hold all of those features like active at once and use them throughout a day.
All right, I'm gonna have to put these links on the Night Shift Facebook page. So look for these.
Yeah.
I'll put these links on the
Give Night everybody Shift these page. Show notes. Ooh, let them into the show into thing stone. Okay.
So, well, a couple things here. You know, part of this, and we've talked about gendering, and part of gendering, of course, is sexual objectification. And as soon as I brought that up, you said we have to talk about Attack of the 50-Foot Woman. So, why do we have to talk about Attack of the 50-Foot Woman?
Well. Why wouldn't you want to? Number one, but do you have the trailer?
Maybe.
Okay, great. Yeah. So for those of you who, you know, are maybe unfamiliar, like I can't like get thee to a rentery. this movie, I mean, just the poster to me is so iconic. It is this when we're talking about, yeah, of sexualization or characterization of women are like what, like we are just talking about like how women use language or like how language is used against them, but we're not talking about like what it means to like be a woman or anything like this. Part of what we're seeing depicted here is like what it means to be a woman, of like what this like iconic portrayal of like beauty, strength, da da da. She's also taller than an entire city, like the white woman's version of King Kong.
Yeah, exactly. All right, so I'm going to play now the trailer for Attack of the 50-Foot Woman.
Once a normal, voluptuously beautiful woman, she drove into a nightmare of horror and saw descending from the sky a titanic monster whose fearsome touch became a frightful curse.
You think I'm drunk, don't you? All of you! I'm not drunk! I'm not! You've got to believe me!
Please.
It was right in the middle of the highway, 30 feet tall!
Once she's in the booby hatch, throw the key away. That'll put you in the driver's seat. You'd make a wild driver, Harry. For $50 million.
What she saw was beyond belief until others, too, faced its hideous, uncontrollable menace. Attack of the 50-Foot Woman, incredibly huge, with incredible desires for love and vengeance.
Wow, she was just a normal, hold on. Okay, she was just a normal, voluptuous woman.
A normal, voluptuous woman. She was an heiress. A normal, voluptuous
woman, that's right. And she was full of now vengeance and wow. Okay. So, yeah, yes. Okay.
A normal, voluptuous woman.
She was just a normal, voluptuous woman. And now, look at her. So, so what, I guess the trailer kind of does say it all. So talk to me now. What is this movie, what should we realize about this film?
Okay. Her power comes from her necklace.
Okay, wow. All right, I didn't know that. Okay.
She gets like zapped. She gets like zapped. But they, you know, at the end, like the quote unquote, like scientist or whatever is like, it's the jewels, like get the diamonds off of her. They're making her crazy. It's that of like, I love it so much.
Snatch her pearls, she'll lose her power.
Snatch her pearls, she'll lose her power. It's only. She's on a rampage because her husband is cheating on her. So, like,
she's
it's
got
not
immense
even like
desires and immense vengeance.
Immense desires and immense vengeance. It is like this old trope of like, no, you know, hell hath no fury, right? Taken to the end is
no
like
fury,
the woman doesn't
like a 50-foot woman scorned.
And she doesn't start like, you know, attacking people until the stereotypes come into play. So I think that's, you know, if you need to know like what women are working against in the workplace, it is everything that is in this movie.
Wow.
But it's also great. It's also great because it actually like was satire, you know, like they were commenting on like a certain type of movie making here. So it's not even like, I'm not trying to say that they started these tropes. It's just they're all on display in this film. And is she even gendered because she's so sexualized? I think is maybe
my
question.
I love that she's wearing like practically a bikini while she's 50 feet tall because, you know, that's all that would fit her.
It grew too. Yeah, it's the diamond.
Of course, it grew as well. Because, well, you know, Attack of the 50-Foot Woman is definitely, you know, that comes back into what we were talking about, too, with just stereotypes. I mean, you have a couple things here. You're talking about policing young women's voices. Now, what was that article about? And policing young women's voices, to me, has a lot of implications there. So talk to me.
Can I say one more thing about characterization?
Oh, yeah, please.
So I think there's this interesting project. It's called the Headless Women of Hollywood. And
I'm sorry. I skipped right
over. Oh, no, yeah. You're fine. It's just we're really talking about language. And a lot of these things that are happening in these like movies, when we're thinking about like sexualization and characterization, a lot of it is passive. Like it has to do with how people like women are presented visually. And also like responded to by men, you know, like the catcall or something in the beginning of a movie scene, or like a woman, you know, like a woman walking to work in the big city, like that, like those kinds of things that like tropes that show up have a lot to do with sexualization or the lack of it, right? Like, you know, you watch a movie like 9 to 5. And that's essentially the entire plot is like women being like, we could be hot at work too. You know, like successful and sexy, like that kind of like, you know, it's not even Murphy Brown. It's it's a little less than that, but it's like still held up as like this feminist, you know, triumph. We see like there's a history here that can be viewed like just in movie posters.
Well,
like,
you
the
know,
way
I'm
women's
looking,
bodies.
I'm looking at the site. Not only do they have women's, all these headless, literally headless women, headless, you know.
Literally headless.
Literally headless. And it's funny, you think about all these iconic, I'm looking at the ones they have here, you know, for MASH. And you know, whatever Weekend at
National Lampoon,
and I even think of, you know, James Bond movies. There's one in particular where it's just a pair of women's legs, and he's underneath them shooting up at her, you know. And there are all these things we sort of take for granted, you know, Porky's, which was again just a pair of legs.
Yeah, so. And even A League of Their Own, a movie about women's baseball team, is just Gina Davis's beautiful legs.
So there it is. So that is interesting, because there's what you're suggesting here to me is that it's not just actual spoken language, the language of women. There's a visual language of women and how we have placed them in our
culture. And this is like the thing, is like this major criticism of Lakoff is like, girls aren't directly taught to be, you know, this, that, and the other thing to men. No, they're not. But like, look at these movie posters. You don't have to sit me down and give me lessons on how to, you know, like what I'm supposed to be reaching for. It's in front of me. It's already in front of me. It's in the sea. It's the sea we are swimming in.
It's grooming. So, do you want to see if any people have any questions? I mean, we've been covering quite a lot of.
I know we've been everywhere. Now. Yeah, and absolutely.
And we still have a lot more we could cover here, because I didn't even read the abstract from there. There's an actual paper on sexual objectification written by Timo Jeten, which is interesting because of what it discusses and gets into. But the phone number here is 212-209-2877. I'm Mike Sargent, and you are listening to Night Shift. We're on here from 10 p.m. till midnight, and we've been discussing women's language, and we've been discussing it with a linguist. And are you a phoneticist? What are some of the things are you a phoneticist?
Yeah,
you're
a phoneticist. Phonetician, lexicographer.
Phonetician. Okay, and all these things. Like, what is a wordsmith then? Is that just somebody who writes, I guess? All right, so you're not a wordsmith.
I guess.
Right,
I'm not too. I do a lot of writing.
Yes, you do. And you do research in sociophonetics. What is sociophonetics? Is it what it sounds like? Just the sounds of society? What is sociophonetics?
I mean, so phonetics is the science of speech.
Yes.
And so sociophonetics is like the social aspects of speech.
Okay. All right. Okay. And the phone number here, like I said, is 212-209-2877. We've been talking about quite a bit here. We have quite a bit more to try and cram into the last 17 minutes here. But you have something else you listed here. When I mentioned you talk like a girl and stereotypes about women's language, you have this vocal fry thing. What is young women's voices, and what are you referring to here?
So vocal fry is an interesting one. I definitely have a little bit of it. It's what voice.
Yes, you do have some vocal fry. Yes,
creaky. So,
but that's also a regional thing too. Like, you know,
okay. So it's yes and no. So vocal fry is a characteristic of certain regional accents, or like, at like a certain period of time, like was, you know, like demonstrably present, like out west. But this is something that actually does like permeate language use. This is why, okay, so these stereotypes where they say like only young women use language in this way, or this is part of young women's language, but a lot of speakers use vocal fry. The people who are most likely to use it are adult males.
That's interesting.
But nobody, it's not really perceptible in their speech. Like, most people never notice it. They don't hear it. They don't associate it with maleness. And so, and the most iconic young woman's regional dialect is California. So the Valley girl, right, has creak in her voice, or has some vocal fry. So like, yeah. And people notice that, make it, it becomes like it a becomes thing that's annoying or associated with young women, because that regional dialect is associated with young women.
And it's so
but creak is something we all do. Actually, everybody has. Okay, we're talking about phonetics.
Everybody's got a little creak.
Rebecca, I love Greece. Rebecca. It is essentially like we all have what they call different phonation types. Okay. Interesting. Right. That have to do with how air moves through your vocal cords. So your vocal cords are either like relaxed or tight. And you could sound like Marilyn Monroe. Use a very breathy voice. Which actually happens when your vocal cords are tighter. Gotcha. Right? Everybody has these different like modes of speaking. So like creaky voice is something anybody can use.
Creaky voice. Now we did have a call here. Let's see. Hello, you're on the air.
Okay.
Hello.
Yes, hello.
Hi. I'm fascinated by this whole conversation tonight. My name is Kim, and I'm calling from up in Putnam County on Nimham Mountain, where the Wappingers have lived for centuries. Anyway, I wanted to ask about rooted in perceived masculinity and trustworthiness. That was a note I made when you were talking about how if there's different languages that are used and how you're perceived more male. And then you were talking about the confident versus the communal as being seen, the confident is male, communal is female. I have my master's work in Columbia in the neuroscience of learning, and women use oxytocin when responding to stressors, actually physical and emotional, which all affects the physical, and men use testosterone. So then you've got this communal of the oxytocin, and you've got the testosterone, fight or flight. And then I wanted to talk about, I am your 50-foot woman. So then I'm 6'7".
Okay.
I'm my father's Samoan and my mother's French and Welsh. And my mother said to me when I was very young, it's your mouth that's going to get you in trouble. And,
wow.
And this idea of, like, you know, they don't know what to do with me. They don't know if I'm male or female, depending if you see me from the front or the back or what I'm wearing. And, you know, when you talk about the larger men's pipe has a bigger, you know, voice or whatever, a deeper voice, they don't even know when I start speaking if I'm male or female yet. So I'm just fascinated by the connection of all of this business of language and gender and society, and I use it, you know, because language has killed women, we know, because the colonists, of course, banished Anne Hutchinson to the wilderness because of what she was saying.
Yeah.
And Lady Dunchmoody was the only woman who started her own colony because the colonists didn't want to hear what she had to say, but she had enough money and backing as a lady to go to the Dutch. She started her own colony down in Gravesend, which is now the end of Brooklyn there.
Oh, cool.
So language. Wow. Okay, fascinating. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Kim. That was great.
Yeah, thank you so much. Thank you so much.
From this idea of language that, you know, boomers working for Zoomers, the one Zoomer said, oh, no, we have to fire you because of your ineffectual communication, but she meant with her younger group, while the boyfriend owner across says, oh, we're going to hire you because of your excellent communication, because I could sell $3,000 worth of pies because I could talk to the mothers and the grandmothers.
Wow. Okay.
Wow. I love that.
How we use language. Wow, what a trip. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Kim.
Thank you.
All right. Wow, yeah. That was great.
I love that you brought up, you know, these differences in physiology, like not covering everybody. That's just one of these places to look where any of the things that we're talking about, like as a science, start to fall apart. Anytime we want to draw like a big hard line and say like, this is what women do and this is what men do, or this is what older people do and this is what younger people do, upon like, you know, further inspection with individuals, it starts to fall apart. It's all just like a useful abstraction so that we can try to theorize anything, right? It is very important to remember that what we're discussing, like, maybe doesn't cover the experiences of individuals and shouldn't be expected to. There's so much to say, especially about like how women get ostracized just for existing. And, you know, when we were talking about like women accepted in the workplace, it is like this interesting, like, there's like a Venn diagram of like more masculine looking women or like taller women and like how they use these types of languages and how they don't, or like what they lean into and what they don't, or ways in which they feel like they have to be more subtle or like more this or more that, because their physical appearance is like perhaps traditionally more masculine. Like that kind of testimony is very common. So it's interesting to be like, not all women, like of course, not all women, but masculinity, trustworthiness, physical appearance, all these things are really, really bound together.
Well, yeah, and let's not even get into how you dress and what that is going to be interpreted like.
Yeah, let's not talk about asking for it with us, like a handful of minutes to go.
Let's not, no. The phone number here again, because there were a couple people calling, 212-209-2877. That's 212-209-2877. We're speaking with Dr. Kelly Wright, and I'm Mike Sargent, and this has been Night Shift. We've been talking about women's language, the history of it, the origin of it, of how we talk about and to women. Now, as we're winding down here, there are a couple of things that you still had here. And you have this thing called mock white girl. Now, is that something I should be, should we be looking at that or listening to that? What is mock white
girl? Well, I mean, I guess I'll say you mentioned just a little bit back about, and like we were talking about vocal fry, like this NPR thing about vocal fry that came out a couple years ago. There's a number of linguists that are quoted in that article, and it is like these women, these maybe like most standard female voices of our time, you know, that like show up on the radio and talk about important things. These people receive like tons of email about how their voices sound, and their male counterparts just don't. Like, people are still sending them plenty of ridiculous emails, but most of the time they're not about how they sound. So every once in a while it's like, I don't like the way you use this phrase, or I don't whatever. But like, you know, you get an email that's like, kill yourself. Your voice is the most annoying thing I've ever heard on the planet. Like, that is like the kind of things these women, these like educated and important women are talking about in this article. And not to say that like their perspectives are more important, but just to say that we maybe think about them as some of the best speakers, and they deal with it. They deal with it all the time. And so it's like laid out here of, you know, why these things are picked out in women's language and not in the language of others, or not these other aspects, which, you know, like I said, what we can measure doesn't always line up with what people perceive.
Now, well, you know, coming back to one of the things I had at the beginning here, you know, when you ask these questions, like if you go into Google and you go like, you know, what is the language of women? It'll tell you like, and it'll ask you like five different ways of asking that. And one of the questions that it generates that I thought was appropriate, it says, what type of language do women use? And then it's got a subheading, which I love this. Conversational management. Women generally use more question forms in conversation and use more linguistic hedges such as I think and sort of, more listening noises such as hmm, and more paralinguistic responses such as smiling and nodding. What's your take on that? Paralinguistic
responses. Well, as a nodder, as a lifelong vigorous nodder, I certainly do this. I think this maybe goes back to...
Now, I just want to say, as a broadcaster and then as an interviewer, it's something that any good interviewer does that, male or female. Like, you're always nodding. You're always making sure the person knows you're acknowledging and getting it. But go ahead, as a lifetime.
Well, and I'll say, like, as someone who, you know, I do interviews as an expert, but then I also do them as part of my research, like as a researcher. And When I am researching in an interview, I have to be really careful not to do some of these things, because I will, in, you know, like my mm-hmms and like, oh yeah, right, right. Like that kind of thing that you'll do in a good interview is really, I do not want any of that on my recording. I don't want my poor research assistants to have to go through and like deal with a billion and a half timestamps because I said, 80 times in 90 minutes. Right. So it's that of it. It became like very clear that it was part of my regular discourse pattern when I started reading my own transcripts back.
Did you say part of your regular discourse pattern?
I did. Wow. I did. You know, idiolect. That's like one of your favorite words.
Yes, I like idiolect.
Yeah, we all have. Everything has a discourse pattern. Like you have ones that you like, ways you say stuff, but then. You could think like, you know, I now pronounce you man and wife, like a wedding, like a regular, like, you know, we're dearly beloved. We are gathered here today to da, 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 da. Like that's a discourse pattern too, you know, so it can be like as informal to as formal. Right.
Well, you know, it's interesting. And we're about to go here in a minute, but it, you know, there are certain things that even when you know, like you only hear women do that, like, you don't really hear men go da 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 da. Really, it's more of a female thing, and again, where does it come from? How does it translate? How does it go from one woman to another? Versus certain things that only men say too. So I think we clearly will be talking about this again.
Yeah, we will, and yeah, I think that. These things like conversational management, paralinguistic cues, it's like a good way to leave off of this, yes. The ineffableness of language. You know, it's very science fiction.
It is. Well, you are tuned to listener-sponsored radio, WBAI 99.5 FM in New York and on the web at WBAI.org. If you've been enjoying the show, please consider making a pledge in the name of Night Shift. You can go online right now to give the number two, WBAI. And go in there right now and make a $30 pledge in the name of Night Shift right now. It'd be great if you did this every month, become a WBAI buddy. But go in there right now and make a $30 pledge. Go ahead.
Right now.
Right now. All right. If you enjoyed this conversation, if this was entertaining, educational, amusing, whatever, okay? And Dr. Kelly Elizabeth Wright, where can people follow you and how?
Well, I'm very easily Googleable. So, Kelly Wright Linguist will get you to me. I have a website there and a Gmail, but I'm the only social media I am findable on is Instagram, where I'm at Betty Machete. It's M-A-C-H-E-T-T-E. So I guess give me a follow there if you want some, you know, communist drivel.
There it is. And I do just want to say again that there is a special screening tomorrow of The River You Step In. And it is at the Atamian House, Havasbian Curatorial Practice, 227 East 24th Street. And it's at 6 o'clock, the reception. You can just show up. 7 p.m. is the film. And 9 p.m. is a Q&A with the filmmakers. Refreshments will be provided. So, until next time, you've been listening to Night Shift, and life does continue to be like science fiction. Do you have any parting thoughts, Dr. Wright?
Right now, I'm just thinking about Mariska Hargitay.
Well, that's right. Don't forget. That's right. Proceeds.
Don't forget it.
Proceeds go to her her fund. Her that she.
My final thought is Happy Indigenous Peoples Day.
That's correct. To the last 3 minutes of Happy.
Yeah, Day. And you're you know, you have a question in here, of like, can language actually perpetuate inequality? Right. And I think Indigenous Peoples Day is maybe an example of, yeah, like us calling it Columbus Day was a problem, was always a problem, was still a problem, was hurting people. And now we're trying to not do that. For them, you know, this really specific reason about like what we call stuff kind of matters.
Exactly. All right. Thank you. Until next time.
Thank you. Yeah.